Some of the charge error that I decided not to raise, quite frankly, was charge error relating to whether or not party liability, and specifically 702 liability.
No, that was pure conspiracy statute, which is a different offense, a different range of punishment. I mean, it just tracks the conspiracy statute.
Yes,
point
or no.
By point, element by element.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're really abandoning that?
Yes, sir.
And the accomplice witness, the failure to give an accomplice witness instruction, you're abandoning that?
No, Your Honor. No.
Did you raise that in your brief?
Yes, I did, Judge. Points of error, I believe 9 and 10.
Okay, I see that. I'm sorry. Okay. And did you raise the question about assault versus aggravated assault?
Your Honor, I decided not to, and the reason I did not, Your Honor, from review of the case law and all that, I believe the court was within its legal right of admitting assault as an alternative to burglary by aggravated assault as a lesser included.
Lesser included?
Yes.
It's a different manner and means.
Yes.
It's an uncharged manner and means.
Yes, Your Honor, I know.
You're not challenging that either?
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, what I am challenging, what I'd like to focus on first of all, is the voir dire error that we raised in this case, or that was raised at trial. And I believe that's the clearest trial error here. And during that voir dire error, Your Honor, we've raised 3 points, 3 jurors who the court did not grant challenges for cause on. And that's our argument that all 3 of the jurors were challengeable for cause because all 3 stated they could not consider the minimum punishment in this case. This was a case where Mr. Waller stood charged with arson, causing a death, and as count number 1. Count number 3, he was charged with felony murder. The range of punishment for arson causing death is first degree. He was also enhanced with a prior felony conviction. So for the first degree felonies, if the prior was proved, he was looking at the possibility of 15 to life. Upon conviction, without the prior being proved, the punishment range was 5 to life. During trial, several jurors and the defense focused mostly on, when they were, defense was voir dire in the jury, the defense focused mostly on the minimum punishment in regard to arson causing a death. Juror number 20, who I'd like to go to first, was Juror Hatcher. I believe that's point of error number 3. Juror Hatcher volunteered when defense counsel was voir diring the panel that he could not consider the minimum where death was involved. That was a proper question and a proper line of inquiry for defense counsel. Count number 1 specifically alleged Mr. Waller with arson causing death. The causing death part of count number 1 is what distinguished arson as second degree, just plain arson, as opposed to arson causing death, first degree. That was a commitment question, understandable, but it was a proper commitment question. It was an inquiry as to whether or not the jury could consider the minimum punishment under the elements of this case as alleged in the indictment. It did not.
What about the facts of this question being asked? It's just, well, we have an arson involving death, and we have all of the surrounding circumstances have been presented as allegations to
Well, the allegation of arson causing death was saying, I believe in the indictment read that Mr. Waller accused Mr. Waller of starting a fire with a flammable liquid or material that resulted in death, causing arson with death. That was pretty much it. It was a bare bones allegation, pretty much, in the indictment. And that's what was inquired into. Defense counsel did not inject any other facts. He did inquire very specifically if you found someone guilty of causing arson, or if you found someone guilty of committing arson that resulted in or caused a death, could you consider the minimum? And it was during this questioning of the panel that Mr. Hatcher volunteered, and in the context, the defense attorney had also been asking at trial, during voir dire, the defense attorney had asked other witnesses the issue of the minimum. Mr. Hatcher volunteered, if there's a death involved, which was one of the critical issues.
Was an element of the offense.
The minimum's out for me. I can't consider the minimum. And Mr. Hatcher volunteered this. The court called Mr. Hatcher back for individual voir dire. And during that individual voir dire, Mr. Hatcher indicated he was not at all confused. He knew exactly what he was saying. He was not confused about the law or anything else. The state, during individual voir dire, before the bench, questioned Mr. Hatcher. And Mr. Hatcher indicated that, yes, he knew exactly what he was doing. If 15 was the minimum, that's what you said. When a death's involved, no, death is off the table. I cannot consider death. He did not say necessarily he would go to the maximum, but he did say he would go to the minimum. He could not consider the minimum.
Are we on Mr. Coronet?
No, that's
on the right one?
Hatcher.
No, Mr. Hatcher, Your Honor. That's point of error number 3. I'm sorry. And I put forth the entire voir dire. I set it out between the state, Mr. Hatcher, and the court. And the state starts off on individual voir dire before the bench, asking Mr. Hatcher.
We've got that.
You've got that. And Mr. Hatcher is very, very, there's no confusion.
Yeah, you've mentioned that. Can you go on?
Yes. The court finally enters into the conversation. And the court says to Mr. Hatcher, I just want to know if you can consider the minimum. Mr. Hatcher, and it's very apparent, tries to think of circumstances that do not include death. And obviously this is an issue in this case involving death, the arson. And the court basically, essentially, keeps after Mr. Hatcher. When Mr. Hatcher volunteers examples where someone did not die, the court keeps after him. No, no, no. And Mr. Hatcher finally says, I don't understand. And the court, during its questioning, obviously takes death out of the equation. Well, this is a critical issue for the defense. It's a right that they have a right to voir dire into in regard to minimum punishment. The court takes that out, and finally the court says, after Mr. Hatcher says, I don't understand, when the court has taken death off the table, taken death out of the equation, Mr. Hatcher says, yeah, I consider the minimum,
okay.
And the court declares her qualified.
What about 13 and 14? They never said they could consider the minimum, is that correct? Only Hatcher did?
No, 14, same thing, Your Honor. This is Ms. Koronick. Point of error, I believe, number
one.
I believe the state indicates that she is confused, but she does not appear to be confused at all in the context of this questioning.
Contact 20 of your brief.
Yes. And Ms. Koronick replies to the defense questioning, if we found someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, why would we go for the minimum? She also tells the defense attorney, I would go to the maximum. She is obviously a hang'em high juror. She is not going to consider the minimum. There is no confusion here. Defense made the proper challenge. The court denied it. And with Ms. Collins, which is point of error number two, Your Honor, she basically agrees with the people who have answered previously before her, who said they cannot consider the minimum. When counsel interposes his challenge for cause, the judge says, I didn't hear it. I didn't hear that, and denies it. Well, the court reporter heard it because it's in the record. And again, there's no ambiguity on her part. Defense's questioning, Your Honor, was not as clear or as concise as far as being blocked out as in the Cardenas cases that I know the court's very, very familiar with. However, the court's questioning clearly was going to the issue of can you consider minimum? And these jurors clearly, over again, unequivocally said they cannot, at least Mr. Hatcher over again. I don't think there was any further duty here. Not only that, defense counsel, although I think Cardina says the magic words are no longer needed, defense counsel did not, when he was addressing the jury regarding punishment, did preface his remarks after the state objected and said you're not asking the question right, if the law allows it and the facts justify it. And his whole voir dire, defense's whole voir dire, is peppered with this phrase throughout. Well, there was no confusion here. The court did not really voir dire the panel itself on the issue of punishment or the range of punishment. However, the state did make an allusion to it, several allusions, references to it, in its voir dire. And at several points, the state's voir dire in regard to punishment was aimed at primarily, can you consider the maximum? The state also, though, asked several individual jurors, can you consider the full range? The issue of what the range was or the issue that you had to be able to consider the full range to be qualified to sit on the jury was before the jury. There seemed to be no confusion about it by anyone. And these three jurors were not confused at all.
The factual sufficiency points you've raised.
Your Honor, on the factual sufficiency, I believe I'm going to waive that in light of Brooks.
You're going to waive sufficiency of the evidence?
Factual sufficiency in light of Brooks. I would ask the court.
Do you want us to consider it as just the Jackson standard?
I would ask.
Are you waiving it altogether? What are you doing?
I would ask the court to go ahead and consider it as the Jackson standard. I think I'm going to have a tougher time on that, in all honesty, Your Honor. But I believe the court, I'm going to ask the court to do an egregious harm analysis anyway.
Egregious harm and is factual sufficiency?
No,
analysis?
Egregious harm analysis in regard to the court's failure to give jury instruction on accomplice witness testimony.
It was objected to. We don't go to egregious harm. We go to Almanza.
It was not objected to, Your Honor. The court failed to, and the defense failed to ask for an accomplice witness instruction. The court did not give one.
Maybe not.
Defense did not ask for one. And, Your Honor, if I can, very briefly, on point of error number 10, where I do take up the matter of the defense not requesting an accomplice witness instruction, I think Davis says it's almost incumbent upon the defense to ask for one where the situation raises it, and one was not requested here. I would ask the court very briefly under the standards set out under the Davis opinion. Davis indicates to us that the court, that the real question here is not necessarily the sufficiency of the evidence, but where defense has asked or failed to ask for an accomplice witness instruction, and one should have been raised, was there a substantial amount of non-accomplice evidence in the record? That would reveal any rational basis on which the jury could have doubted or disregarded the evidence. Your Honor, the main witness for the state in this case as to what actually transpired about a fire actually being set, who was involved, was the accomplice witness LeMaster, Alan LeMaster. That's clear in the record. At the time he testified, he had been recently arrested and charged during the middle of trial. He was testifying with a prosecutorial gun to his head. Thank you.
May it please the court, excuse me, Edward Wilkinson, Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, representing the state. As a housekeeping matter, initially, if the defense is going to request or is going to submit a post-submission brief on the issue of legal sufficiency, the state would ask for leave to file a post-submission brief on the same issue if it's going to be submitted to the court. Turning to the first three issues that appellant has raised regarding the voir dire issues, this case presents one of those rare instances in which a court's first encounter with a recent opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals, the state maintains, will be to distinguish that very case, and I'm referring to the Cardenas case, probably mispronounced that. The case itself, however, offers the very basis on which this case may be distinguished from that precedent. In Cardenas, the court held that when voir dire members have been repeatedly told of their obligation under the law to consider the full range of punishment for the statutory offense, and there is no indication of their confusion, the complaining party need not ask any follow-up questions regarding their full and complete understanding of the law to preserve error. The implication in that is if there is indications or there are indications in the record that the voir dire men are confused to whatever level that may be, then in order to preserve error, it is incumbent upon the complaining party, the defendant, to follow up with questions to the voir dire men to establish their full and complete understanding of the law and their obligations to follow that law. And the state maintains, and it's argued in more detail in its brief, that each of the three voir dire men of which appellant now complains register various levels of confusion in their remarks to defense counsel regarding the issue of the minimum punishment. I'll start in numerical order with voir dire man Dawn Collins, which was number 13. She is the one who simply said, "I agree with what the people around me are saying." When she volunteers that, the two voir dire men immediately before her, who also happen to be sitting next to her, one discusses whether he could consider the minimum in relation to intoxication, if the defendant is intoxicated to whatever level, and that is a reference back to a hypothetical that the defense presented much earlier in the voir dire. And the voir dire man before that spoke in relation to whether they could consider the minimum or a lower sentence in a hypothetical presented by the state where the defendant was not one of the ringleaders or the person who had organized the crime, but simply a lower-level accomplice. So the state maintains it's unclear in the record there to what exactly she was referring, because in both of those scenarios, a voir dire man is not required to consider the minimum. They're not required to consider the minimum if the defendant is intoxicated or if the defendant is not a ringleader, a mastermind, if you will.
What about the statement, if we found whoever guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, why would we go for the minimum? It just seems like a slap on the wrist. It's page 20 of the appellant's brief. It just seems like a slap on the wrist if someone died. If someone has died, then someone needs to be held accountable for that, and somebody should. Sure. So I would go to the maximum. And would you always go to the maximum if we found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, you're regarding the Kelly Kornick, I think is how it's pronounced. She makes those remarks well before the other two voir dire men and well before Collins refers to it. But the state would also maintain that she shows or indicates some level of confusion in that on two bases. One, she talks about why would we go for the minimum? Why would we give the minimum? Which is different from the legal standard of whether you can consider it or not. And she says that twice, which is further indication that perhaps she and the defense counsel aren't on the same wavelength. He's talking in terms of, well, can you consider it in just as a statutory offense? And she is asking the rhetorical question, well, why would we go for that? Why would I give the minimum? And the follow-up question to that rhetorical question is, well, we're not asking to give that. What we're asking you to do is, can you consider that? And the law obligates you to consider that if you're going to be a juror. And if you can't consider that, then you can't be a juror.
If I can't give it, how can I consider it?
I'm sorry?
If I can't give it, how can I consider it?
To a certain extent, you can consider it. Yes, in theory, I can consider it. If under the right factual circumstances, and this goes back to the old hypotheticals you used to see in Vore Dire a lot, where they'd do in a murder case, you know, what if she was dying of Alzheimer's and in great pain and her husband of 60 years shot her? You know, could you consider it under that sort of scenario? There is some sort of situation where you might consider it, even though you can't conceive of any literal situation where you would give it. That's different from, you know, I don't think I could give it simply because I lack the imagination to think of some hypothetical right here and now where I might consider it. But all Vore Dire is playing with rhetorical devices. And venerem in particular are not often very articulate and are not attuned to the nuances and subtleties of the law and the terms that are being used in Vore Dire. And the state's position is, where there is some indication of confusion, the burden is going to be on the challenging party making the challenge for cause and raising the point on appeal to clarify the record when they can, with follow-up questions establishing whether the juror understands the law and understands their obligation if they're a juror. We maintain in all three of these situations, with all three of these jurors, that's not what occurred, that there was some indication that they didn't understand what their obligation was, and that the burden was therefore on the defense to ask some follow-up questions. And I think that's particularly important where you get a situation where they're actually articulating something or making some verbal indication that they're not on the same wavelength, if you will, as opposed to those situations where you just have a show of hands. You know, 20 or 30 show of hands. Here in these situations, the state maintains, each one of them has some level of indication that they didn't understand what was going on, and that should have signaled to the defense that more follow-up questions were needed.
Did the state have an opportunity to rehabilitate?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the state have an opportunity to rehabilitate? Wasn't there
It's not really a rehabilitation. Rehabilitation would suggest that you can come in and say, well, no. Rehabilitation, I guess, would be the state. And yes, the state could, but then why would you put the burden on the state or the opposing party to rehabilitate a juror who's obviously confused when it's the challenge, if I understand your question correctly, whereas it's the party that's trying to challenge them and is going to have to articulate the objection to the trial judge, and if the trial judge makes a ruling they disagree with, take the record up on appeal. Why put the burden on the other party? Why require them to come in and clarify whether the juror is confused or not?
What indicates confusion when she says, if we found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, why would we go for the minimum? I would always go toward the maximum.
This is Juror 14, Cornick?
Cornick.
Well, as I said, what the state is emphasizing is she says it twice. She says at the very beginning of her recitation, why would I give it? She says it repeats it at the end. I think the fact that she repeats it is significant. And she, in between those two bookends, goes through the reasons why she doesn't think she can give it, which is, as we got into, a little bit different from whether you can consider it in some hypothetical situation or not.
Well, you know the line of cases that involve Larry Baraka, where he said, if you come back before me, I'm going to give you the maximum sentence. And you know that line of cases where the judge tells what the sentence is going to be before the revocation. And that was held to be an indication that of a biased trier fact. And that's what I think Vore Dire is, to determine whether the jurors have a bias, whether they can follow the law, or whether they've prejudged the case to any extent. So why do we apply a different standard to a juror if there's no indication of confusion? If she states, I mean, like the juror that says, well, if we find him guilty, I can't give probation. You know, you don't probate people who don't find guilty. But So that's my
I understand your question. I think I understand your question. And I think the key is whether there is indications of confusion on the juror's part. And Cardenas is the one that says, and relying on Gardner, where, by the way, both Benjamin in that case say, I'm confused. They actually stated on the record. But I think the Court of Criminal Appeals is catching there in referring, in relying on Gardner and in its specific holding, and including this in its holding, they're purposely saying, we recognize, you know, Verdier is as much an art as it is a science. Jurors get confused pretty easily. And in those situations where a juror is confused, we're not going to overturn a trial judge on the basis of either an ambiguous record or a confused juror. And I think that's important to emphasize the role of the trial judge here. When the veneermen are confused or do appear confused, a lot of times it's not going to be simply what they say. It's going to be their gestures, their facial expressions, any hesitations that usually don't show up in the record. And the trial judge is going to be the one who is going to be able to assess those right there, and therefore this court needs to defer to that sort of thing. So where the record is ambiguous, or the state maintains where the record's ambiguous, or where the juror appears confused, you should defer to the trial court's ruling on the challenge for cause, because he or she was there to see the juror's reactions to the questions or lack of follow-up questions. Does that make sense?
I gather the tenor of your argument is that the defense counsel failed in his duty to come up with some clarifying questions to nail down the inability of the juror to consider the minimum punishment, which, however, are more arrows in the quiver of ineffective assistance.
Yes, it's said far more articulately than I did, but that encapsulates the state's position. That where there is some indication of juror confusion, it is incumbent upon the defense, the challenging party, to follow up with questions or explanations that make it clear to the juror that this is what their obligation is as a juror. Can they follow it in spite of their hesitations, which has always been the law in voir dire challenges? And this is simply to make the record clearer, and both for the trial judge and for the Court of Appeals reviewing the record.
I've got a question.
Okay.
If the jury found the defendant guilty of arson and the deadly weapon used is the accelerant, how can you reconcile finding of no deadly weapon?
The state actually did it in a footnote. I don't remember which one it is. There are two explanations, actually. One is they just ignored the jury, the deadly weapon findings. They just said, you know, either we don't care or we recognize what the import of that's going to be, and we're not going to go along with that. The second explanation is in the – see if I can find it. Yeah, that's the voir dire part.
I think
you
want to be
footnote. The one is what? Oh, here it is. And I'm quoting right from the state's footnote. Footnote 8. The jury could have concluded, that appellant had conspired with the Cervantes. The two brothers broke in and set the fire with the Cervantes to simply set fire to Greg's apartment and did not intend to hurt or kill anyone. They recognized nobody was in the apartment. But it was something that they could have or should have recognized might have harmed or killed someone. You know, setting a second-floor apartment on fire, a reasonable person would recognize might harm someone else in another apartment. And then reason that he didn't intend to use or use the accelerant was, didn't intend to use or use it in a way to, in a manner that was intended to be used to cause death or bodily injury. In other words,
okay,
they didn't mean to, and therefore they didn't use it as a deadly weapon, but he's still guilty of the arson because they should have foreseen that it could have hurt or killed someone.
Then doesn't that indicate that the jury actually paid attention to the jury charge when the trial court instructed them they could convict under the law of conspiracy rather than law of parties?
It suggests to me a very overly analytical reading of the deadly weapon instruction. The jury, I think, was being conscientious in that. It's a very hyper-technical interpretation of that. But I don't think it suggests that they're relying solely on the conspiracy or even that that even came into play when they were looking at the deadly weapon issue.
That was my concern, that it was an indication.
But I don't really think it implicates, if I could finish the sentence, I don't think it implicates if what you're referring to is the 702B. I think it's simply an hyper-technical interpretation of the deadly weapon instruction.
No, my problem was it wasn't a 702B instruction. It went actually to the conspiracy statute and set out the elements of the offense of conspiracy. And then the jury seems to find conspiracy by not connecting it to the deadly weapon.
I'm familiar with your dissent in Barnes.
Yes, yes.
The state prays for an affirmance.
Very briefly, Your Honors, defense's voir dire was proper, and appellant in this case, defendant, Mr. Waller, had a right to jurors who could consider or entertain the minimum punishment, not under a certain set of circumstances, but just in general. And they clearly, the three that we've discussed, clearly indicated they couldn't. They weren't qualified to sit on as a jury. It's that simple. And once they've been as unequivocal as they can in their responses, I don't think it's incumbent upon the defense attorney to say, well, you just have to say you can consider it. You don't have to give it. He has a right to know what these people's true feelings are, and that's what his questioning unveiled. That's what the responses were, and they were clear and unequivocal. There's no confusion there. Again, it's not as nice and neat a scenario as the Cardonas case, which pretty much had a bow on it. It was so nicely and neatly wrapped up. But the responses are just as affirmative, just as unequivocal, and just as unclouded, and just as unconfusing. And quite frankly, Ms. Koronick, when she said, why would we consider the minimum, I think when you read it in the context, that's really, why would any fool go for the minimum? She's already told us she's headed for the maximum. There's no confusion there on her part. She's expressing her opinion. I believe that juror bias and prejudice was uncovered in the voir dire examination. Proper challenge for cause was made. It was improperly denied on all three of these.
So do you think there's no that the distinction that the state draws is inaccurate, that they're is no distinction between considering and giving the minimum?
Maybe theoretically, Your Honor, but when you read the record in this case and from what the jurors were saying in this case and the tenor of the voir dire, no, I don't think there is a distinction. I think in this case to argue that that was a significant distinction is, quite frankly, a distinction without a difference. I don't think there was one. If there was any confusion, it was with Mr. Hatcher, and the confusion was created by the court itself. If there was any confusion on any of these jurors' parts, it was with Mr. Hatcher, created by the court. Very quickly, Your Honor, the deadly weapon findings are just... or the failure to find the deadly weapons, I think are irreconcilable with conspiracy charges for arson and probably felony murder too, where the jury had to find under conspiracy theory that appellant anticipated the act.
He wasn't charged as a conspirator.
No.
In the indictment, that's a different offense with a different range of punishment.
Yes, and he was never charged as a conspirator.
The jury was instructed on the elements of conspiracy, and if they could convict, if they found the elements of conspiracy as opposed to finding him guilty as a party, aiding, abetting, encouraging, etc.
Correct.
Or as the primary actor.
And the jury was not required to make a unanimous finding. For example, in the charge on felony murder, the charge of felony murder, the indictment, the count for felony murder, was submitted to the jury in their charge as felony murder by a party under 702A, or felony murder as a conspirator under 702B. And we can't tell what the jury was doing, or what the jury was deciding, and there was no unanimous, there was no vehicle for the jury to return anything other than a general verdict. The same with the arson charges.
So you're saying he was charged as a party and as a co-conspirator, even though he wasn't indicted as a co-conspirator?
Yes, Your Honor. And the arson...
Is that your argument?
Well, what I'm saying is the jury was not required to find a, make a unanimous finding. Is he being found guilty as a party under 702A, or is he being found guilty under 702B? The jury was allowed to return a general verdict, and essentially 702...
Do you understand what I'm asking you? The elements of conspiracy is an offense, right?
Yes, Your Honor, under 1502.
Totally different offense with a totally different range of punishment, and you have to be indicted for conspiracy.
Yes.
And I'm asking you, when you say the jury wasn't required to return a unanimous verdict, and you're saying, and this the court instructed them on each element of the law of conspiracy, are you saying they were allowed to convict him as either a co-conspirator or as a murderer, arsonist?
Your Honor, I believe what I'm trying to say. It was my belief that under the law, that even though I don't agree with it, and I read your Barnes concurrence, that I understand that 1502 charges a separate offense, and these were the elements alleged. They're also almost always the same elements that are alleged and under any 702B theory that is submitted. And our courts have just consistently held that's okay.
Not consistently. Okay.
So that's why I didn't pursue
any
that.
Questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, your case is submitted. We appreciate your argument. Are you going to submit any more briefing, or do you just want us to consider your sufficiency challenges under Jackson without additional briefing?
Your Honor, I'd respectfully just ask the court to consider it under the Jackson standard.
Okay. Thank you. If you want to respond, Chip, can you do that within 10 days? If you want to respond, do you want to, can you do that within 10 days?
To the sufficiency?
He wants us to consider his factual sufficiency under the Jackson standard rather than the factual sufficiency
as,
that
we
argued.
As I indicated, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
No, go ahead. That's fine.
As I indicated, yes, if the court is going to consider the sufficiency under Jackson rather than the now refuted or rejected
Lewis.
Factual sufficiency standard, then yes, the state will brief it.
Oh, well, he's not going to submit any more briefing, but if you want to,
state
10 minutes, okay? All right. Thank you. You are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.